Because the railroad ran close to their home in Kingsland, one of Cash's earliest memories was the sound of the train whistle and the sight of migrant families huddled in boxcars. Sometimes his father would take the leftovers from their family meals and offer them to the hungry travelers. The mystery of the railroad and the symbol of hope it represented would remain with Cash throughout his life. In 1934, Ray heard about an experimental community being set up in northeast Arkansas, part of Roosevelt's Federal Emergency Relief Administration, FERA, provided resettlement for the families worst hit by the Depression. 16,000 acres of reclaimed swampland in Mississippi County was bought in order to build a model farming community. Each family would receive a newly built house, 20 acres of land to clear and cultivate, a barn, a mule, a milk cow, and a hen coop. The town center would have a town hall, cinema, cotton mill, cannery, school, hospital, churches, cotton mill, and shops. To ensure the best market price, all the cotton picked would be collected by the colony and sold in bulk, with proceeds divided equally among the residents. Initially known as Colonization Project No. 1 and later named DIAS after Arkansas's Emergency Relief Administrator, W.R. DIAS, the colony offered Ray Cash the chance he needed. His family, now seven strong with the arrival of baby Reba in January 1934, would have a new start. The project also offered the added incentive of eventual property ownership. FERA maintained a strict selection criteria. Applicants, besides having to prove their genuine need, needed a strong work ethic, outstanding moral character, and the skills to clear and farm their own land. Ray was one of only five people chosen from Cleveland County. His experience in cotton picking and forest clearance stood him in good stead. On March 23, 1935, a pickup truck came to collect the family from Kingsland and drive them to their new home. Carrie, Louise, and baby Reba sat beside the driver. Ray and the three boys rode beneath the tarpaulin in the back, along with a few family possessions. Though a mere 250 miles, the journey down narrow, icy gravel tracks and dirt roads took a day and a half. Carrie lifted their spirits by singing hymns, the most memorable to Cash being, "I am bound for the promised land," probably because the heavenly hope chimed so perfectly with their earthly aspirations. "Oh, the transporting, rapturous scene that rises to my sight. Sweet fields arrayed in living green and rivers of delight. I am bound for the promised land. I am bound for the promised land. Oh, who will come and go with me? I am bound for the promised land." The landscape was flat and uninteresting, the soil rich and dark, and freshly painted white clapboard houses with porches at the front dotted the roads that led out like spokes from the town center. 90 miles of ditches drained away the rainwater to prevent the land from turning back to swamp. When the Cash family pulled up to House 266 on Road 3, the paint cans still littered the living room floor, and the yard was waterlogged. But this two-bedroom home was the biggest and best they'd ever lived in, no matter that the road was little more than a dirt track, or that it was a two-mile walk into the town, or even that they had neither electricity nor running water. To Ray and Carrie, it was paradise. In Dias, everyone was on equal footing. There was no division between rich and poor, native and newcomer, or manager and worker. All of the 500 families arrived around the same time and in the same economic condition. Each family had the same style of house on the same amount of land and shared the same opportunity to improve their situation. Cash would later remark, "I grew up under socialism." Dias families were expected to be essentially self-sufficient. Every household had a cow for milk, hens for eggs, a mule to pull the plow, and hogs to kill for ham and bacon. They grew corn for bread and biscuits and alfalfa to feed the livestock. They collected rain in barrels and firewood from fallen trees. Government home economists showed the women how to can their fruit and vegetables for the winter months. Besides clothes, oil, matches, sugar, coffee, and flour, little else came from the store. "We had plenty to eat," says Joy Cox Gower, who grew up a near neighbor to the Cashes. "It might not have been what we wanted, but there was plenty of it. We didn't want for the necessities of life." Each colonist began by clearing the land and preparing it for planting. Having never been cultivated, the land, though full of useful nutrients, was also choked with trees and thick undergrowth. Ray and 13-year-old Roy started by chopping trees and tearing up the undergrowth. By the end of the year, they'd managed to clear and plant 3 of their 20 acres. They cleared more during 1936, but early in 1937, heavy rains flooded the Tyronza River in one of the main drainage ditches, putting the whole area underwater. Carrie and the young children evacuated to Kingsland. Ray and Roy stayed at the house, but after a week they also had to leave. Only one family held out. Armed deputies in boats patrolled the area to prevent looting, while radio broadcasts from Memphis kept the now scattered residents informed of the water levels. For a while, it seemed that the whole dream of a new life would literally be washed out. When the Cashes returned home on February 16th, they found the inside of the house covered in silt and their land dotted with driftwood. All things considered, they'd gotten off lightly. The worst things they faced were the snakes who had taken refuge in the barn and the hens who had laid eggs on the living room sofa. Ray reckoned that the deluge had made the soil even better for cotton, and he was soon harvesting 2 bales per acre, as well as soybeans and corn. By the time he was 6 years old, J.R., when not at school, was helping out in the cotton field. He started as the water boy, but when he got older, he carried his own 6-foot-long canvas sack to fill with cotton. The work was tiring and tedious. The increasing weight of the sack hurt his back, and the sharp spikes on the cotton heads cut his hands. Yet, when he looked back on his cotton-picking days, he didn't remember the pain, but only the love he learned for the land and respect for diligence. Music provided both a relief from the hardship of work and an escape to places beyond the limited horizons of this perfectly designed community. Farmers sang hymns in the fields to pass the time and take their minds off their aching backs and bleeding hands. Inside, music on the radio brought a magical world from down the railroad, where the lights were brighter and the buildings were taller. "Nothing in the world was as important to me as hearing those songs on that radio," Cash remembered. "The music carried me up above the mud, the work, and the hot sun." If correct, Cash's reminiscences reveal that, from an early age, he had almost a mystical connection with music. He realized that music did things to him, that it could create states of consciousness like nothing else. When he thought of beauty, the most beautiful thing he could picture was a song like "Vacation in Heaven." When he thought of God, he thought of songs like "I'll Fly Away," which to him were prayers. "These songs carried me away," he once wrote. "They gave me a taste of heavenly things." The first song Cash recalled hearing on the radio was "Hobo Bill's Last Ride," a ballad that told the sad tale of a railroad bum who dies of neglect. It contained many of the elements that would characterize Cash's future: storytelling, the railroad, loneliness, poverty, a marginalized character, and death. Perhaps unsurprisingly, his favorite book at the time was a 1918 Western titled "Lone Bull's Mistake" by James Willard Schultz. Ray Cash thought his son was wasting time by listening to the Grand Ole Opry on WSM from Nashville or the Wheeling Jamboree on WWVA from Wheeling, West Virginia. He took the view that popular music kept people's minds off what was important and filled their heads with escapist rubbish. It wasn't a view that Carrie shared. She played piano at church and sang to her children in the evenings, and she wondered if her son might follow in the footsteps of her singing instructor father. By 1939, Roy Cash was playing in an amateur band with 4 classmates. They called themselves the Delta Rhythm Ramblers. The fact that his brother performed and had been on KCLN in Blytheville made a deep impression on the 7-year-old J.R. Cash. Though they never made any recordings, the Dice Eagle in April 1939 reported that they won first place in a local talent contest held in Portia and would consequently be competing in a statewide contest in Little Rock on May 15th. Unfortunately, the band broke up when World War II drafted all the members. Only 2 survived the war. Meanwhile, the births of Joanne in 1938 and Tommy in 1940 completed the Cash family. With Roy away in the Navy, Jack became JR's biggest influence. Named after the former world heavyweight champion boxer Jack Dempsey, Jack Cash was tall, strong, cheerful, hard-working, and passionate about his faith. He read his Bible assiduously at home, tried to base all actions on Christian principles, and wasn't afraid to defend his beliefs in front of others. To J.R., he was everything a boy should be.